What's up, guys? It's Stephanie
and Shelby,
and we're from Tame. This is our second podcast episode. We haven't gotten together for a while, and we're excited.
Yeah, we're just going to catch up a little bit, and then we realized we didn't do a whole lot of introductions last time, so we'll do a quick check-in and see how everyone's doing. It's Sober October that we're running through Tame right now. So we've kind of been putting out some challenges to increase some self-awareness around just substance use or maybe really any kind of addictive issue or whatever you may have.
Yeah, I don't know if I have even said this on here, but if you haven't checked out our website, it's under construction. It's tamegrandcounty.org. We have a good friend, Zach, that's building it for us because we work a lot and we don't know how to do those things. So we're relying on him. So he's doing awesome. Check out our website. And we thank you for tuning into this podcast right now.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on this journey, this wild and unpredictable journey that we are on. The podcast is just one of these exciting things that we both are really loving to do, and we're excited to bring more of this to you. So we kind of want to back it up a little bit and start from the beginning.
When we recorded the first one, we just like recorded a voice memo on an iPhone, like we're doing right now in my living room in Fraser, Colorado. And we didn't think that like it would happen that fast and it would get on Apple and Spotify, and like we just looked at the stats and we had like 50 something downloads, and that's exciting for us. We're like, whoa, we didn't think it was gonna, I don't know.
Yeah, I remember Stephanie texted me right after she uploaded it, downloaded it, whatever, like I don't even know the terms yet, and my reaction was, oh shit. It's so exciting, but just sitting here talking in the comfort of the living room is one thing. And then when you realize that it's leaving, it's like, woo, what are we doing? But it's so important. And so we're going to cruise boldly forward.
I think it's like really important to be vulnerable. I didn't know that there was so many people out there that had been through similar situations or needed to hear my story until I put my story out there.
And that's exactly it. We don't even realize that what we've been through may seem kind of ordinary in our lives or may seem like something we need to keep quiet and be ashamed of, when all reality, there's so many people struggling with those same issues. And we're taught from a young age to buck up and deal with it and shove it down and be quiet. And so the more opportunities we have to kind of break this silence and be like, look around and see that, yeah, maybe we're not doing things the best way possible, that, you know, it helps break down those walls of shame and just help us realize we're not alone in this struggle. And while we all are unique humans and we all have different experiences we go through, it's ultimately the human experience that makes us one. And
we all share the same thoughts, feelings sometimes, and it's really all about putting ourselves out there and making the connections with each other that have really the same, not the same, but similar experiences.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite quotes that stayed with me forever, and it's not the exact quote, but the idea of it, and it's that, there are billions of people in this world, and while we all are unique in our struggle, like, we're not the first ones to think the thoughts that we're thinking, and we're not the first ones to come across these issues that we're coming across, because we all are human, and we all crave ultimately the same things, and we all have the same defense mechanisms, and how that looks is different from person to person, but at the end of the day, that common thread of human experiences is what guides us, and that's where we need to relate, and that's why we share.
I think that's just like, that's how we find friends too, is having that common ground with somebody else. You know, I mean, we wouldn't know each other unless we had addiction and recovery in our experiences. That's where we all come together with some common ground, and we can talk about it and learn from it and grow from it. And we came on here tonight. We just helped a really good friend clean out a bedroom, did some organizing for Tame. We are offering all kinds of services, such as that, like in-home organizing, cleaning, just anything that you really need to get well and that can change your life.
And it really comes down to looking at the person in their whole environment and the person as a whole, and understanding that we can't thrive if we're waking up looking at something that brings us pain every day. And so if we wake up and we're already miserable and already 10 steps behind, you know, it's really hard to just shake that off and be like, all right, let's start from here, you know. So
absolutely.
If we can help get you out of that hole a little bit, just to where you can start stepping on solid ground again, that's our main intention. So it looks different in everybody's life what you need, you know. And so for a lot of addicts or people struggling with depression or anxiety issues, waking up and looking at your pile of laundry and looking at just dishes, it seems impossible to get out from under sometimes.
It could be so overwhelming waking up to an atmosphere that you're like not even prepared to deal with mentally. Sometimes, like, let's talk about being not okay. Like, sometimes it's just okay not to be not okay. And I actually was complaining to a friend. I'm like, I have dishes in my sink and I never do that. Like, what's wrong with me? And he looks at me, he's like, you're human. You're just human for a second. And it's okay. But we don't want to wake up to an environment that brings us down, like you said, because we're just going to start off our day in a yucky mood. So I try to make sure to make my bed every day. How about you?
It's on the list most days.
My bed's not made right now because I've been off for a minute.
My life right now is up in the air, and the beds that I sleep in are pretty different from night to night. And so, yeah. I mean, I make a lot of beds, but I don't ever know if I'm going back to the same one. And so finding routine is what I'm trying to really grasp right now, because when everything changes, the only thing constant that we have is ourself. And so when we root into those routines, we can find balance even in the midst of nothing around you to grasp onto. So that's where I'm at with the bed making question.
Yeah. I mean, I try, but I don't know. It just sets me off on the right step.
Yeah.
When I make my bed in the morning.
Definitely.
So we're going to do intros, and we're going to start off with Shelby.
Yeah. So I guess where to start with everything and why I am with Tame and how Tame got developed, I guess, the idea and then the story behind Steph and I. So I grew up in Grand County, Colorado, Tabernash specifically, and my family was very prominent here, I guess you could say. The Newberrys were well known. There was three brothers that moved here from South Georgia. And so with that comes a lot of personality, and they all got wives and settled down and had got houses and had babies, and they played a big role in the ski area. They all worked for grounds crew and stuff. My mom was a travel agent for the resort as well. So, like, I went to preschool at the base of the resort and spent half my day in ski school and half my day in preschool. And then, you know, just kind of growing up in the valley and being part of a family in this county is really what it is and what it comes down to. And it's just such a unique perspective growing up in this mountain town, and one that I didn't realize how fortunate I was to be part of until I left it. And came back, and then left it again, and came back again, and left it again, you know. And so I had this love-hate relationship with this county forever. And it all stemmed from a very kind of traumatic teenage years. Before that, I had a great childhood. Both my parents were very stable. both of them were coaches. My dad did t-ball and baseball and Little League, and mom did softball, volleyball. Dad ended up doing basketball. So they were just known throughout the community. Mom became a teacher. Dad became a county commissioner. So then again, even more out in the community. And then as I went through high school, my parents took in a total of 5 kids as foster kids throughout my time. And I absolutely adored that. And it gave me just such a different perspective on what life can be for other people. And it gave me a view outside of my little perfect bubble of what I thought a family was and what life was. And so all of a sudden I had my curiosity drawn to the darker side of life. And I was very curious, and I was very much pushing the envelope everywhere in every way that I could. And it was about middle school when mom and dad say that the aliens came and took me away. And that's probably pretty accurate. And that was around the time when I really started drinking and smoking weed. Not as much smoking weed, just because, you know, I couldn't, I had a cycle. It would be smoke, and then I would giggle for about a half an hour, and then I would eat everything in the kitchen for a half an hour, and then I'd pass out. And so smoking wasn't the best for me as a teenager, but drinking, you could just go, you know. And then I just was very promiscuous from early on. I ended up meeting my first love of my life at in middle school. It was 6th grade when I met him. I had eyes on him in 5th grade when our different teams played basketball against each other, but Mikey was the light of my life and the center of my life for a long time. And when I met him in middle school and we started dating at 11 years old, maybe 10, who knows, off and on, my whole kind of perspective shifted. And I went from this idea that, like, if you drink and use drugs, that you are never going to be anybody or make it anywhere in life. And then all of a sudden I started dating Mikey and had these group of friends who, you know, they were drinking at school and it was fine. And, you know, they were still like doing okay and played sports. And so all of a sudden I had this just shift of perspective of like, oh, if they can do it, I can do it. And that was it. My first foster sister, she ended up moving back with her mom around, I think it was the end of 7th grade, maybe beginning, I can't remember, the timeline's hazy, but when she moved back to Fort Collins, I went down there for my 13th birthday, and it was the first time that I got blacked out, and I remember playing some card game. And there was 4 bottles of liquor on the table. And it was my foster sister and I and a boy and her mom's boyfriend, I think, sitting around. And I just remember grabbing each one of the 4 bottles and just opening my throat and chugging. And one was tequila, whiskey, vodka, and rum. And
yikes.
I was sloshed.
Yikes.
Like, immediately. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I remember trying to crawl across the floor on all hand, like all fours. And I would reach forward with my right hand, and then my butt would fall on the right. And then I just roll over and laugh. And then I try to get back up and crawl with the left and fall. And I just remember this feeling of like, I love this. Like, I loved not feeling in my body. And it wasn't until just recently that I understood why I loved that feeling. But so that was, so that continued on through middle school, through high school. My ex and I, Mikey, we were very, very in love, very passionate. And that didn't always translate well when you mix alcohol and teenage hormones, is what I'll kind of level that out to. And it was hard at times. We were definitely, I know, gave our parents a run for their money, and they didn't really know what to do with us, I think, most of the time. It was like, well, there's Mikey and Shelby, like, there they go, like, let's, and, you know, I just thought that I was gonna marry this kid forever, that he was it. You know, I ended up dating him off and on until I was 21, so that's a big time.
It's in a long time.
Your life, and very important years, and, the first time we actually got in trouble, we, well, real big trouble, we were on our 8th grade field trip going to Washington, D.C., and it was a whole bunch of 8th graders and a few chaperones, and of course, all chaperones' eyes were on Mikey and Shelby, because we were just, like, making out everywhere we went, and, like, sneaking away, and, like, we were very sexual at that point. I believe I was, like, 13 when I lost my virginity with him, but it was, like, right around that, so we were just, like, raging hormones, and it was terrible. So everyone's, you know, watching us, and then when we disappear the first night together, obviously the search party goes out and we get caught in a hotel room together in Washington, D.C., and our buddy's watching, like, standing guard at the door, making sure that no one's coming, and so he starts knocking on the door when the chaperones are coming down the hall. And my immediate reaction is, oh shit, jump out the window, like, crawl over, Spider-Man it, scale to the next floor. And I looked down.
How did you guys get a hotel room?
Because the whole school, like, we got all hotel rooms through, like, all the students had them. But we didn't have one together, so we snuck off and used
somebody else's hotel
one
room.
Of his, yeah, I think it was his room. I don't remember the details at this point.
His friend was, like,
yeah, our buddy Dominic was watching the door. And
so
he,
you guys could have sex.
So we could go be dirty in eighth grade.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, I was, like, about to jump out this window and scale the building to not get caught. Because my, like, I'm like, I'm going to get away with this. No. So anyways, we end up getting caught, no shit, and I end up sleeping on one of my teacher's floors, and he sleeps on the other teacher's floors. But that is our first big time that we are in trouble. And it didn't get better from there. Like, him and I just, I think our rage is probably what was best described, but we got very physical at times, and we would immediately be back into that love phase, though. It was the very typical, you know, domestic violence wheel. And you see it, you know, in the world. And I ended up actually becoming a domestic violence advocate years later. And not only because of that relationship, there was obviously others. But I just, you know, we were kind of real toxic for each other, and that's really hard to grasp at that age when you think that that is everything, you know. And so we did, we cheated on each other, we drank, we smoked, we did all the things, we snuck out, we got caught, you know. And then we should have had 2 kids together too, and I ended up getting abortions because I was 15 and 16 years old, you know. You can't raise a kid when you're a kid, at least, and that was my thought at the time. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to ever give these children what they needed in this world, and that to me is very important, mm-hmm. above all else. And since then, I don't think I've ever come to terms with ever, like, wanting to be able to have kids again because of that experience. Like, I had my chance, and I'd passed, and so now I still have work to do around that, but, like, obviously there's things that come up with that still. And in that relationship, though, Mikey ended up getting into opiates, and I just am so thankful that that wasn't my drug of choice, because, you know, ultimately that led to him ending his battle with addiction, because, you know, when you can't afford the opiates anymore, the next best thing is heroin. And, you know, I got a chance to speak with his family just a few months, like a year after he died. Maybe it was like two. It must have been 2 years after he passed away, because I had to get sober and clean before I could face them again. And because when I went to his funeral, I was not sober. And it was awful. It was awful to have to look at that family and take full, like, I felt like I was the one who caused his addiction. And I felt like I was the reason that he wasn't around anymore. And I'm just so thankful that, like, that wasn't my drug, you know, because I would have been right there with him. And when he first started selling and, like, snorting oxys, I definitely tried a few lines and stuff. And at that point, I say that cigarettes saved my life, because I snorted an oxy and then tried to smoke a cigarette, and I didn't like it because I threw up and was like, well, I'd rather smoke than snort that, I guess. And so I was like, well, nope, not my thing. Mm-hmm. And so I guess
cigarettes saved your life then.
Yeah.
In a very weird way.
But it's taken a lot of work to come around to the idea that I am not responsible for that. And It took a very hard conversation with his family to come to that. And it's in these hard conversations that we usually, if we don't have them, that we leave ourselves imprisoned in our own world that we have created. And the world that I had created for myself was a very shameful, guilt-ridden world. I was very guilty about not having the children. I felt very guilty about Mikey, you know, losing his battle with his addiction, and I felt like I was at the like the center of it. When he first got prescribed his oxys, it was because he punched a dude that I had made out with, you know, and broke his hand and couldn't play basketball anymore and like got pins and all this stuff, and I took that just like my fault. And then the next time we got in a fight, our freshman year, after we graduated from high school, our freshman year at college, and he ended up jumping out of my car while I was driving around Red Rocks, and he like launched himself out while we were going 40 miles an hour and broke his collarbone, and I ended up sitting in the hospital with him all night in the ER and like had to pretend to be his sister and stuff. And it just, you know, just these moments where it's like, you know, I had to walk away. And I think it was around that time when I, you know, I had to move, and I actually physically moved to Key West. I was like, I will never be able to get away from this kid because I just love him so much. And there was nothing that was going to keep us like sane together. Like I knew it, at least not at that point in our lives. And so I ran away to the Keys, going as far away in the country as I could, and really trying to escape. And it didn't work. I got into some real dark stuff down there. And at one point, you know, my mom and I had a conversation, and I don't remember it, but she brings it up now. And she goes, Shelby, do you know what it's like living with a daughter who, you know, has a death wish or is suicidal? And I was like, you know, I don't feel like I'm suicidal, but I don't care if I die, you know, and I don't ever remember saying that. And so to hear that years later is like, I can't imagine what I was putting my poor parents through. And not to mention that, you know, right before my senior year of high school, my brother died in a wakeboarding accident. And so going into my senior year, I had already had two abortions, gotten my first DUI, lost my brother, and then my parents got into a little thing, and one of them had an affair, and my family was falling apart. And it was literally one hit after another, and as a 17-year-old kid, you don't know what else to do but just say, I'm fine. And that's what I did, but it didn't, you know, I didn't keep it together as good as I thought I did. I still got basically straight A's my senior year. I graduated as a freshman in college. When I finished high school, I graduated finishing an EMT basic program, so all I had to do was take the National Registry, and I was an EMT. I had done, you know, the clinicals and the ride-alongs, and so I was a very high-functioning alcoholic, very high-functioning, traumatized person. And so when I ran to the Keys, I was trying to outrun all of that. I didn't know that that's everything, you know? I didn't know that that's what I was outrunning. And my best friend at the time, she was my roommate and my housemate for the first 3 years in Fort Collins, and she got accepted to a study abroad program in New Zealand. And so when she went to New Zealand, I went to Key West, and I went into scuba school. So I was going to be a scuba instructor, and
that'd be so cool.
It was interesting. I don't know what my issue was.
Such a jack of all trades.
Crazy is what it is, I think. So I get down there and find a roommate, and I say I'm going to sober up, and of course that's not true. I'm like drinking worse than I ever had. Because no one knew me, and I had no one to finally, like, spy on me. It was growing up in Grand County, where everyone knows your business, everyone knows your family, to going to Fort Collins at CSU, where half your school went to Boulder, half went to Fort Collins. So it's like, you know.
Fresh.
Everyone knows your shit. So I get down there, and no one knows me. So one of the first things they do is I marry a Hungarian so he can get his green card, because everyone down there marries people for green cards. And he can't even, like, repeat after the magistrate.
You, Marianne?
I did it. Yeah, I did.
Well, how did that happen?
Well, I got talked into it, and I was drunk, and it seemed like a good idea, and it was, like, going to be good money, and I only had to live with him for, like, 2 years, and da-da-da. Like, no, it was a terrible idea. We only lasted, like, 4 months, and I realized, like, he can't speak English, and I'm not going to prison over this dude, so we got divorced pretty quick, but... Ronaldo, I think. But...
Oh, my.
It was scandalous down there. We got into some stuff.
And was he at least cute?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was. But the funny thing was, is at the time, there was two dudes who were going to marry me. And the first dude would have been legit, because he had an actual girlfriend and an actual kid. Like, he legit just wanted his green card. He spoke English and had money and a job and, like, all this stuff. And I was like, no, I'm going to go for the hot one that can't speak English and don't really know if he has money.
Oh,
I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
There was red flags everywhere.
But it looked like a bouquet at the time.
Yeah.
The red flags.
Yeah. Everyone at the restaurant I worked with were like, oh, yeah, I'm married to this dude for that, and I have this wife because of that. And so that's,
totally
like,
normal.
What they do down there.
What?
So I thought I was going to do that, and it didn't work out. I never got money, and then all of a sudden he wanted to, like, actually think I was a wife, and I was like, you don't know, I don't know you. So then, my dad actually had to come down and get us divorced, so that's a whole nother thing. He came down, like, guns a-blazing, like, yeah. He was like, you were part of, this was, like, the Hungarian mafia, Shelby, and I was like, no, it wasn't. He's like, yeah, you're dealing with the fucking mafia. So probably
Oops.
Not the best choice I made.
Oops.
Oops. Dad saved me again. But yeah, so that was just one gemstone from the first trip down there. I ended up kind of dabbling in cocaine a bit. That's nightlife, you know, bartending, and that's just what happens, especially in the Keys. And so a shady dude is in and out of the picture for a minute, and... You know, I think the first alteration, it was, yeah, first, like, fight we got into, I don't really remember. I'm pretty sure he drugged me at my house. And, you know, the next morning I woke up and, like, the mirror on my wall is shattered. My computer is shattered. There's glasses just all over the kitchen broken. There's blood. Like, I'm bruised from head to toe. Just fucked. Like, I have no idea what happened. And I look outside and my car's gone, and I'm just, like, alone in my apartment, like, what the fuck, you know?
Oh, my God.
And I call my girlfriends. It's my girlfriends were this lesbian couple at the time, and the one was, like, my all-time favorite person in the world. And her girlfriend thought we were having an affair, and so she was always, like, kind of, like, weary of us together. But so my girlfriends show up, and... You know, they're helping trying to clean up a little bit, and the neighbor comes out and start talking to them, and he's like, oh yeah, we called the cops, and this dude got kicked out of here, and he took your car, and like, he's not allowed back in the because I lived down on the golf course in a gated community in Key West, and so they're like, he's not allowed back in here. And so I'm like, all right, piecing together the night. And they're like, we just heard this crashing and banging, and so we called the cops. And that was kind of like...
You didn't even wake up?
I don't remember any of it. Like, I have no recollection of any of that.
Wow.
And then, like, I kind of locked myself in my apartment for the next few days. I ended up calling the tow truck company. I got in touch with one of them, and my car had been towed halfway up the Keys because he had left it running in the middle of the streets, like, downtown Key West, like, running with the doors open, I guess. And so they towed it. But this dude, well, so the next morning, right, my girlfriends are there, and they're helping me search through everything, and... she goes, Shelby, are you smoking crack? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't know. She's like, I found chore boy in here. I'm like, I don't even know what that means. So she, like, pulls it out and, like, shows me how you, like, smoke crack and, like, finds all this stuff. And he left all these different cutting agents that he was going to cut his cocaine with in my apartment. And so he ends up coming back a few days later and is like, my other girlfriend, she knew him too because of the blow. And so all of a sudden, like, a few days later, because of my drunkenness, because of the drugs, call it whatever, like, we're back hanging out with him one night on Main Street. And that's pretty much the last thing I remember. And I think it was like a 3-day is kind of what I've gathered, is 3 days that I was locked in his apartment, and I was, like, handcuffed to his toilet, and he basically just beat the shit out of me and raped me. And I don't, you know, I have, like, flashes of it coming in and out, and there was another girl there, and, like, I remember, like, doing things with the two of them, but, like, I don't, you know, like, that, I don't remember that, you know. And I finally got out of there the third day. He left, and I promised that I wouldn't leave if he unlocked, like, if he let me off out of the toilet. And so I end up, like, he left to go to the grocery store or something. I don't remember what he said, but I jumped out of the window. It was, like, the second story window. And I, like, ran the 2 miles back to my apartment in, like, barefoot in booty shorts and, like, a bra midday. And, like, that was it. And I was so scared to call the cops. I was so scared to do anything because I felt that I deserved it because I had gone out and drank. And that, you know, I got what I asked for, is what I thought for years. And I even went to work to tell my boss, you know, a few days later to grab my money and paycheck. And I'll never forget this. She looked me dead in the eyes and she goes, "That's what you get for being a slut." And it was there that it was like, there's nothing here for me. There's, you know, I'm bloody, bruised head to toe, and that's the answer I get. You know, we're just fucked as a society. And this is coming from a lady who would, like, chase us around and badger us and be so rude, and she's, like, drunk and on pills every night. And it's like, who are you to cast a stone, you know? And so I got back from the Keys shortly after that and came back to Colorado and went through rehab and didn't take the first time. Then I got forced into rehab, you know, the second time. And it was because I tried to kill myself. And it's, you know, it's just such a messed up thing that we do. We tell people that they're broken. And we tell people that there's no way out of it unless they take this pill and they surrender their life to, you know, God. It's like the only way that we were taught or told the first time I got sober, and I didn't want to accept that because...
You mean the 12 steps?
Part of it, yeah. That was part of the rehab that I was in, was 12-step based.
They made us religion.
Yeah, based. Religion. I was at the point where I had no spirituality, there was no God, there was nothing, you know? I was like, you fuck this world, we're in it, we die, that's it, there's no meaning. You know, the world is not fair, life's over, grow up.
Is that why you think it didn't take the first time?
Yeah.
Or just because you weren't ready at that time?
I wasn't ready to do the work.
The inner work.
Because it's easy to say, like, I quit, and once you stop, you know, it's okay to, like, stay stopped. And they call that white knuckling it as an alcoholic when you just don't drink and you don't change anything else. So you're still
dry drunk.
Mm-hmm. So you're still hanging out with the same people, going to the same places, but you're just not drinking. Like, that's what I did. And it doesn't work because you're, like, you get put in these social situations and you have to question all the time, like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just have a beer like they are? Or why can't I just have a few drinks and go home and, you know, like... And then I had this boyfriend who was an amazing boyfriend, and he stayed with me through this suicide attempt. He stayed with me through rehab. He stayed with me through all of this, you know. And at the end of the day, you know, after I was sober a year and a half almost with him, it came down to me just feeling like I didn't want to feel like a broken person. And I wanted to be able to go out and have a few beers with him at night and not feel like that weird girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so that's what ultimately I was like, you know, it's okay. I got this. I went a year and a half. I can drink again. No. There was no control.
So that's really just an addict's mind or an alcoholic's mind that just tells you, it's safe for me to do this again. I went this long without doing it. Let me try this over. Maybe I can get a handle on it this time.
Yeah, I got it this time. And so it took me starting drinking again and destroying a beautiful relationship. My ex that stayed with me through rehab, He got me into hiking. He got me on 14ers. He got me, you know, living a lifestyle I would have never lived on my own. And we had a beautiful life together. We spent summers in our tent, in our camper, and we did big road trips. And when I told him 3 years into our relationship, hey, babe, I'm going to go study abroad in South America for 4 months, he goes, all right, when do I get to come visit? You know, like, ultimate support, ultimate best friend. And he really footed the bill for the last part of that whole trip and just, like, never blinked an eye and was just 100% down. And I ended up destroying a really, really good, beautiful relationship because I was so self-absorbed in my drinking. And it was so deep and far gone that I didn't realize that that's what I was doing even. And so at the end of the day, when I was coming home from, I was doing my undergrad at Western and finishing my Spanish and sociology degrees, and I would get drunk at school all day, and then I would go to happy hour, and then I'd go to class, and then I'd go drink after that, and then I'd go be a domestic violence worker. And, like, it was just messed up, and I'd be hammered doing it all. And then I would get home to him, and I'd be like, all right, let's go have a beer, so I could, like, mask the scent of all the booze on me and let him think that I only had one beer that day. Like, he's not an idiot. He knew I was drunk. Like, come on. But he didn't know how to act either. Like, he didn't know how to face me, I don't think, and he didn't know how to have those conversations because I wasn't going to have them. Like, I wasn't
You'd
the
be
problem.
In denial anyway.
Oh, yeah. I was not the problem, you know? And so he ultimately, like, was the greatest person I ever had in my life. He, like, got me through thick and thin, and I ended up, like, shutting down a really important thing, and it was all very ego-driven. It was all very addiction-driven, and it took even, you know, after we split up, I spiraled down for a good year and a half. And right after we split up too, like, a few months later is when Mikey passed away. And so that was, like, a big kind of slap in the face too. It was like, you know, you lost your good relationship, and then you lost the only person that, like, you know, knew you from your whole thing, like, everything. Your one main person to go back and forth between, or your brother, wait, he's not there either. So all of a sudden I was, like, back in this just empty hole of the universe, like, fuck this. You know, I'm alone, and this isn't fair, and I don't care. I don't care. And so I ran again, and, you know, I did. I went and trimmed drugs. I trimmed weed for a while and ate drugs every day, and I just, like, went off into a different world for a while. And then I went up and said, you know, enough's enough. I got my shit together. I went up to Idaho, but I was at a different world, you know. I was working in an elementary school, working in the special ed department, in a Spanish-speaking school, teaching math to fourth and fifth graders. Like, they didn't want to hear me teach math in Spanish. Like, they're in special education. Like, that's the last thing they want to hear. So that job was brutal, you know? And, like,
I can't imagine.
The kids are like, murr. You know, they don't want to talk. They don't want to do that. And so then after I leave the school, because they didn't pay enough, obviously, to support a life in Jackson Hole in Idaho. And so I would go work at a disability home, a transitional disability home for people with mental or, like, traumatic brain injuries and people with cerebral palsy and that kind of stuff, where they are highly functioning but need a little bit of assistance. And so that was my other job, was a caregiver. So I would go from working in special ed to being a caregiver at night, and I wore myself out, like, spread too thin. And I remember going on one date with one dude, and I pre-gamed so hard before he even showed up that, like, we got to the dinner and ordered appetizers, and he was like, nope, you're going home. Like, put me back in the car and drove me home. And, like, this was me in this state thinking that I could be of service to people in the world and, like, had something to offer. And it's like, you gotta take care of you, you know? Yeah. I was burning the candle at both ends, plus some. You know, like, torturing myself, left a great relationship, had a great time in Crested Butte and messed around with too many men, got in a really bad relationship it was a good relationship that I messed up. I cheated on the dude, and it was the worst thing that I think, I don't know, it was one of the most impactful things that's ever happened to me for some reason. Like, I cheated on this dude, and I lived in hell for it for years. Like, I didn't forgive myself. And I was like, you know, I knew I was at the worst point after I cheated on him and got caught. And I was Googling in my self-pity, like, why does it matter if you cheat on somebody? And I remember, like, after I Googled that, setting my phone down and being like, you are fucked in the head, girl. Like, you're broken. You're broken. Mm. And that was a big slap in the face. And I needed that. I needed to go through that. And I had this whole idea built up around me because I was helping at the domestic violence center and I was doing this and doing that, that I was this good person. And everyone around me was telling me, you're a good person. But I didn't believe it, and I knew. And so I acted out in this way, I guess. This is what happened. And, man, that one hurt. And so I ended up, you know, it took a few years to process that. And it took a few years of running and, you know. So, anyways, jumping around in my story, because my story jumps so much. Sorry. I go from Idaho, hating that, back to Grand County, back home. I live with my cousin for a minute, and she helps get me back on my feet. I get sober for about 2 months, and I'm moving to Key West again is my next plan. So I'm moving back to the Keys. I'm going to be a sailboat captain. So I load up my car, put my dog in the car, and we drive down to Florida, and I start working on boats at 28 years old, 29, something like that, 28. Never worked. I'd worked on a boat for a little bit before, but like knew nothing about boats. Jump on a boat. Love it. But at the same time, there's a learning curve, and when you reach kind of like the point of where you do the same thing every day, all day, for 9 months, I don't do well in that environment. Like, I need excitement, and I need to be intellectually challenged, is what I've learned. Mm-hmm. And so even in paradise, the best job in the world, I'm like around all the dudes who are half naked with muscly bodies every day, and I'm like in heaven, right? And I'm miserable. And I'm looking around, and I'm like, I'm still broken. What the fuck is wrong with me? You know, I made it 2 months sober, got down there, and just drank my balls off again. And then, you know, it came to the point where November was creeping back up, and November is my brother's birthday, and it was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm in paradise, and I'm miserable, and I want to die again. Like, and I called my mom, and I said, hey, I'm thinking about killing myself again. And I, you know, I'm drunk. I don't remember this conversation. I don't know how it went down. But my mom just, again, was like that helpless feeling of I am thousands of miles away and I can do nothing, you know. So the next morning, or I think it was the day, I can't really remember how it went down, but my boss at the time at Danger Charters in Key West, he is an amazing man. And Captain Haig, he showed up at my house that morning, and he packed up my stuff with me, and he drove me to the ferry boat that ultimately got me up to Fort Myers, and then from there I caught a flight home. And so, you know, it was like my boss showed up, and all my crew that I worked with showed up, and they helped pack my stuff and send me home. It was like one of the most powerful moments, you know, that my boss, he's a recovering addict, alcoholic himself, and so he's actually agreed to do a podcast with us as well eventually. Yeah. Which is awesome. So Captain Haig is the shit. But yeah, so he helped pack me up and he sent me on my way home. And you know, it was really cool to turn around this last year going back there sober and being like, you know, could I ever work on the boats again? He's like, sober you? Yeah, come on back. And it's like, holy cow, you know, the things that we tell ourselves, like, never again would these people let me work there, never again would they accept me back. It's like, they are all open arms and supportive, and it's like the power that we hold in just taking care of ourself is beyond imaginable. Like, we don't even realize the opportunities that await us when we just get our shit together.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it was coming back from the Keys after feeling completely hopeless again and getting back into Winter Park, and you know, I floundered for a little bit. I got in trouble. I got a DUI, my fourth DUI, 2 weeks after my 30th birthday. And that was it, you know. I drank a few months after that, and I ended up moving to Denver and running away down there and meeting a psycho dude who I was doing blow with all the time. And that's when I met the construction worker and was doing meth with him some mornings. And it just was not a good situation. And I was, like, convinced that that was better for me than swallowing my pride and moving home. And ultimately it took like death threats and, you know, a knife to my throat and a bong chucked at my head and shattered behind me, and been like this dude turning into a crazy stalker. And, you know, like I got a job as a nanny and I didn't feel safe going to this house thinking that this kid could show up at any point. And so I surrendered, and I had my dad pick me up and he drove me up to the mountains, and I got to work remodeling his house, and that's how I got sober. It was a lot of falling and a lot of running and a lot of trying everything. You know, I spent 10 years in college grabbing every degree or getting as close to finishing a degree as I could and realizing, that's not me. And it took finally getting sober and looking at every terrible wrongdoing I've done and everything that I've done, and accepting it with myself, forgiving, you know, those around me for what they did to me, and realizing that we're all operating from a place of pain and we can't help but act out what's been done to us. And until we learn to recognize that our reactions are responses to things that we've learned involuntarily, you know, we just have to find some grace in that. And it really became my mission to turn it all around when, you know, Mikey lost his struggle, and it was like, I'm going to lose mine if I don't turn it around. And if I can't stay inspired for myself, like, I have to stay inspired for him. And now within that, and being able to like reach out to his family a few months ago and really just fully lean into this yoga journey, my life changed completely. And it was getting into yoga that I got sober, and I wouldn't have done it without it. The community, the tools. And it was in a PTSD trauma course that, for the first time ever in my life since, you know, I have just come to terms with the fact that I was molested as a child and touched multiple times by multiple people, and I didn't realize how bad that affected me till just recently. And I'm just now coming to terms with all of that. And so through the healing process and recognizing and understanding all of this, just understanding the strength we have in healing ourselves through yoga is like mind-blowing to me. And just the few, you know, the classes that I went to specific for releasing PTSD and trauma work, you know, I walked into a building and met seven strangers, seven women, and I sat in there for 2 hours and did breath work and meditation and like holding yoga poses. And I left there and I cried the entire 2-hour drive home from Denver because I had never felt such relief. And I didn't know that I wasn't living in my own body for the last, like, I don't know, 20 years of my life.
Wow. That's and powerful.
It's beyond, you know. And so getting into the yoga and just knowing what it's done for me, it's beyond powerful. And then so getting into my master's program and following the addiction counseling program and realizing that talk therapy was a big part of that addiction counseling program. And I can't just do the talk therapy. You know, yes, it is very necessary. And if had I not been in talk therapy while doing the yoga, had I not been in all that, I don't know if I, you know, would have gotten as far. It definitely helped, but yeah, where my passion is and where I'm finding my voice is in this yoga and the few people I've been able to help just since going through this. You know, I've seen them walk out with that same relief, and I've seen them walk out with the tears, and I've seen them, you know, they've told me the difference it makes. And so I am putting my master's to the side to fully dive into the only thing that's ever brought me true healing and relief. And I just, you know, this is my mission. This is where I need to bring this to the world. And I had somebody who had seen me struggle through my addiction, you know, seen me struggle drinking, working at the same restaurant together when I was like, you know, 13 to 21, that pivotal age time working at Hernando's. And, you know, these people saw me drinking and saw me go through the worst of the worst. And so Katie Fisher, you know, she saw me on my last day there when I told a customer to shove a Pepsi up their ass while I was drunk, you know. So Katie's seen me bad, and she's seen me get better. And there's just so much power in that. And I lose sight of that You know, I'm like, who am I to do anything in this town? Who am I to bring this center? And looking back at it, it's, you know, I feel like I am the voice for so many in this community, just because we all feel these traumas together, and that's what these are. Every time we lose a friend in a good community, you know, another community member, that's family, and we all feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds up. And I feel like I've always just been this, like, kind of container of grief, like, holding a space for people to have their grief. I've lost my best friend in fourth grade. She disappeared and never came back. They never found her body, anything.
Oh, God.
And, you know, her mom said she came back as a hawk. And I've always thought that people, you know, this has been, like, a thing. But regardless, I just feel like that I've had this connection to these people in this community in such a way, and I, for some reason, have always interacted with grief a little differently. And so if anything that I can bring or offer, it's just a space to allow you to feel that grief, because we all are feeling it, and it looks different. Like, it's easy to say, like, trauma, and it's easy to say grief, but what does that mean? It means you can't sleep at night. It means you lose your appetite. Or maybe it means you eat everything in sight. Maybe it means you lose interest in activities, or you can't show up to social events anymore. It means you can't fill up your grocery, like, you can't get groceries. Like, you just physically don't want to go to the store. It means you won't cook a meal. It means you won't do your dishes. It means you're scared to answer the phone or reply to texts. It's anxiety. Like, that's what this is. That's what trauma and PTSD is. It's not being able to, it's having an overreaction to something that doesn't deserve it. And so what yoga does is it teaches us how to regulate those emotions again and those addictions. And addiction is shutting down those responses in a way that we've learned how. And typically it's not a healthy response. So That's where I come from, and that's kind of the support that I want to offer, and the empathy that I want to offer, is that, you know, I've lived in the gutter. I have lived on the streets, sometimes on purpose, you know. I backpacked through South America for a year, and the people who I became the closest with were like the bums and the homeless people and the people who didn't judge you. And there's so much power in human connection, and those are the things that I remember the most, right? Like, not the bar that I went to. I don't even remember the names of the towns, but I remember the faces of the people that took the time to teach me Spanish, you know? And that's powerful, and that's where value is, you know? And so Tame came from the idea of, I started a blog, Taming Wildfire, because I felt inside that it was wild. I didn't understand who I was when I quit drinking. Like, I quit and I put myself on Anabuse because I couldn't walk by a bottle without just chugging it. So if you take Anabuse, it makes you physically ill. If you try to drink, you have an allergic reaction. And so just by me taking that pill every morning, it gave me that just, like, nope, you can't drink. And so every day I knew for 3 months, like, okay, I can't drink, I just can't, you know. And by the time I made it through 3 months, I felt solid enough to cut the Anabuse out, and I did. And then I had the discussion with my doctor because I still had terrible night terrors. I was waking up sweating and screaming, and I had terrible flashbacks and all of that. And she prescribed Trazodone, and I hated the prescriptions. And so we had the discussion, you know, about smoking weed, and if that's natural and that is what takes care of your trauma, she was like, do it. You know, and this was going, like, coming from my doctor, like, smoke weed instead of take these prescriptions. And this is coming from when I was going through probation trying to get sober. And, you know, the probation officer is like, if that keeps you sober, smoke weed, you know. So, like, the shift that we're coming to realize is, like, natural is better. And we have research now providing the evidence that we need to say, like, hey, if weed or, you know, whatever kind of CBD treatment or whatever kind of remedy, there's ketamine treatments now coming around. There's all different kind of substitutes for painkillers that are coming out. We can talk about that more. But there's all these just different things coming out now that are holding more weight than just continuing to use the same things. Mm-hmm. And so really exciting things coming.
So many exciting things.
So many.
Thanks for telling your story. I really enjoyed it. This is actually the first time that we have actually sat down and talked about all of it.
Yeah. And there's obviously lots more to it, but there's the skeleton work, you know, like, it's hard to kind of piece it together, right? And so that's what a big component of talk therapy is, and what I found a big part of my healing was, is in that first 3 months or 4 months of getting sober, was I sat and I wrote down my story in a book, and I was like, whoa, I feel a million times better.
I really, really would like to do that. There's definitely blocks of my life that I don't remember. And sometimes think people will bring things up. And then I'm like, oh, well, I forgot about those like 4 years of my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the more work that we can do internally, and the more we can just check our own interactions, and I think one of my favorite things I've been hearing over and over now is, like, we have to check our own role that we play in our own suffering, because a lot of it really is on us, you know, and we get so stuck on this, well, I was put in this situation, and this is, language is powerful. What we tell ourselves matters.
Mm-hmm.
And where we pigeonhole ourselves, because that self-talk of, who am I to deliver this service, or who am I to speak this truth, or who am I, you know, I spent so many years discounting my own truths because I was a service industry person. I was a bartender. I was customer service. The customer is always right. No, that does nothing for like boundary work and confidence and deciding who you are. Like, the customer is wrong. But yes, thank you for listening to my story, and I hope that I didn't put anyone to sleep, and please, like, reach out and ask us questions, and I know you're listening, so, you know, share your story if it helps too, or even just share your story with us in confidentially, and we will, you know, maybe share it for you without a name or anything. But I think the more we can just put these stories out there, the more we humanize it and realize, like, hey, we've been through some weird stuff, but we can get through it.
Absolutely. If anybody wants to write us, send us an email. It's B as in B-E dot tame LLC at gmail.com. Anybody's welcome to send us an email. We'll even read it out loud if you'd like us to.
Yeah, and ask an addict. We want to open that up too. So, like, you know, ask us anything that's come to your mind. Like, if you're a family member who doesn't get what your addict is doing, or maybe you're an addict that, like, just, you know, we find support in things. Like, we talked to someone tonight that, you know, is going through the probation process and the interlock process. And I'm like, man, I spent 9 years of my life dealing with interlock, and I spent 16 years of my life on probation. Like, if anyone can answer questions, I've got you. Like,
absolutely.
So ask us anything. We're open books, and we're here for information. So
we definitely have a lot of experience in, well, all of those areas. Probation, addiction, harm reduction,
school. We can go on.
Coping mechanism, screwing over our family.
Yeah, fixing
up.
Burning bridges and then rebuilding them when they're ready to be.
Gosh.
You know?
Getting into debt, getting out of debt.
Getting in and out of debt. Ooh, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
That one feels real good. That's like a put in the W column and keep it.
I was going to teach a financial wellness class.
After your vacation, babe, this girl needs a vacation.
Yeah, I've kind of been off lately. Like, I don't know what's going on. I haven't even made my bed, like I said. It, like, really throws me off.
You gotta quit burning your candle at both ends.
I know, seriously. Do you see that whole list of houses I have to clean?
Give me some. Share the weight.
No, yeah, working two jobs, going to school.
It's a lot.
And tame.
Yeah.
But hey.
And it's okay. All about filling your cup. Like, I love that analogy, is you can't pour from an empty cup, and you can't receive if your cup is too full. And so it's all about finding the balance. And, like, say if you work so much and you're always over here, work, 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 when that pendulum comes down, everything has a rest and relax point. And if that pendulum comes down and swings back and you've left nothing there, your house is a mess, you don't have anything to come home to, you know. We got to take that balance in it. And that's what I'm learning too. It's how to fill up those low times so you don't go too far.
For some reason in my mind, I've always, like, since I've gotten clean, I've obviously had a job. But in my mind, I have to stay busy.
Yeah.
Because it keeps me out of trouble.
Yeah. An idle, what is it?
What happens though when I'm bored? You know what I mean? If that's my coping mechanism, and I'm just always busy, 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 and that's how...
There's your work.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's your work. That's what you have to figure out, is how to entertain that still in boredom and be okay with that still.
Yeah.
Because that's where I'm at. It's hard.
It is really hard. So but, we all still struggle.
Oh, I mean, what? Far from perfect.
Yeah. We all struggle. And it's never going to be like, I've got this. No, you know? It's like a total lifestyle. It's an everyday thing that you have to work on yourself and what you're going through. And
it's about filling up the things that make you happy, because there are just little things that, you know, would make me happy that don't speak to you. But, like, I am nerding out about my little plants lately, and I am just, like, having a little plant orphanage, and it makes me so happy. So
I need to repot that guy. Will you help me?
Oh, we need... Yeah, I need to have a whole repotting day, so...
Yeah, that'd be fun.
But... That'll be an activity. So, yes, we're going to do some pumpkin carving at Tame while Stephanie goes on vacation. But I'm we're going to do jealous. Pumpkin painting and carving. And, you know, come on by. Just have some chats, you know, send us an email.
If you guys are in town next Saturday, we're going to do paper mache spiders at the Wellness Center at noon.
Yep.
We'll be doing all kinds of, well, they will. I'll be gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. She deserves it. I think everyone should go on vacation. Mandatory vacations.
Thanks for listening, guys.
We love you so much. Have a great night. And just remember to be light with yourself. And we didn't get fucked up in one night. We're not going to get it all out of the hole in one night. So.
Right? It takes time.
When you're going through hell, just keep going.
They say put as much effort into your recovery as you did getting high.
Yes.
Or getting drunk.
Yeah. All the same.
All right. Happy Sober October. And happy Halloween.
We love you. We'll talk soon.
Bye.